Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 82 at the very beginning, which is old single column page 913. Okay, so after a long stretch there on Adam and Eve and their consequences, we're ready for the next block of papers. We have the three papers on marriage and family. And you know, anyone who's read for any time is probably familiar with these papers. Everyone will be challenged to be objective about their sex and not take offense when the revelators talk objectively about the two sexes. It's always good to, in your quest for greater humility, to start close to home. Start with some humility about your nature and its limitations. You know, if you can master some of that, then you can expand out from there. Obviously, lots of things, when you speak directly and factually, are what we now call politically incorrect. But you know, definitely, when you get to the point of, you know, the foundation of these three papers, marriage, if you have some sort of wild idealistic delusions about what you are, good luck with any sort of a relationship. I mean, the fundamental potential in a real relationship is the incompleteness of each individual in the relationship. You discover that you're half, and your spouse is the other half. And if you put the two halves together into a whole, there's a super additive consequence that can't exist any other way than by completing, by bringing together those two separated halves. We were created apart so that we could come together again and produce something that didn't exist before. Matter and spirit were separated so that they could come together in a super additive consequence and bring into existence that which didn't exist before in the Father. We've talked about many times. You start with, you know, the Father is the first source and center. Speak generally about the first person. Sure, he's infinite and all kinds of glorious attributes and whatnot, but he's just that existential foundation. The point of everything removed from that starting point is to separate two elements that are homogeneously blended together within him to, you know, run us, you know, some sort of a filter, right, through his nature. It's like, okay, here's all the spirit stuff over here, and then run another filter. Okay, here's all the physical stuff over here, you know, and now they're separated, which they can't be within him. And now that they're separated, there's a potential for a super additive consequence. You know, so like I said, everything beyond the Father is above the Father. Right? It goes super additive. And that's the whole point, to flesh out all possibility, to not just duplicate the beginning, for instance. You know, that, you know, you're trying to produce in a marriage relationship, you know, something beyond what you ever imagined could come from you. You know, it's something that is in no way, shape, or form even a remote extrapolation of you or the other. Right? It's, that's the whole point. So you have to recognize just how different you are, how what limitations you are. You always start with know thyself, like the Greeks figured out in the 6th century BC. And then proceed from there. Okay, so let's jump into it here. Well, I've got some other introductory things that I want to say with the very first paragraph here. So let's get that out front here.
Paper 82, The Evolution of Marriage. Marriage, mating, grows out of bisexuality. Marriage is man's reactional adjustment to such bisexuality, while the family life is the sum total resulting from all such evolutionary and adaptive adjustments. Marriage is enduring. It is not inherent in biologic evolution, but it is the basis of all social evolution, and is therefore certain of continued existence in some form. Marriage has given mankind the home, and the home is the crowning glory of the whole long and arduous evolutionary struggle.
Okay, just a quick little thing on how it ends there. We've talked about this many times. We saw this, and going to the civilization papers, whatnot. Again, reminding you of that fact that the family or the home are these foundations of all other human institutions. Everything is predicated on that fact. And if you don't have that fact, you can't have anything else, really. And then up front, there in that opening sentence, so you see the bisexuality. Just like we're pointing out, that's the basic mode how everything works. You have two facts that are separated, right? That's why there's two sexes. It's the same reason why there's just two substances, matter on the one side, spirit on the other, or the unqualified absolute on the one side and the deity absolute on the other. I mean, it's that exact same bifurcation fact to set up the potential for a relationship. Not a system, just a relationship. And when they throw in parenthetically their mating, of course, they're saying, well, okay, in an immediate sense, mating grows out of bisexuality, just as an immediate biologic, even animal fact, you could say, as those animal urges. But then you saw them, kind of explain as you got in a little bit, that the biologic fact of mating leads inevitably to a social fact that evolves through social evolution, marriage, the institution of marriage. And so you get that all in your head, and then as you go forward, it's strengthened. But you could, if you reflected very precisely and clearly right up front, it's like, okay, I get it. I've already discovered, this is paper 82. We've been reading a lot of papers. We've already discovered that they're trying to always bring the usage of language into a very precise mode so that you can stop thinking in foggy terms, right? God is not to be found in the fog. Right? Just remember, that's why you want to be able to think precisely, because you want to find that still small voice that a foggy mind can't find. Right? It's got to be a well-focused, microscopic mind that finds that still small voice. You can find what appears to be one, your inner voice, your conscience, okay, but that's not God. We all know how blaring your conscience voice can be. That's obviously not a still small voice. Okay. The word marriage, see, in this precision mode, they're suggesting, especially because they knew where we would go in subsequent decades and how confused we are now about this word. It's like, no, you should, if for no other reason, it's historical predicate. But the enduring historic and ongoing fact that generated that word, they're saying marriage should be a word that's used just when you have a mating, child-producing pair, in a social, institutionalized state. You know, so if you wanted to get more precise, if the point of the two people coming together, no matter what sexes they are, same sex, different sex, whatever, if the point is not to produce children, that's technically not a marriage. That's some other type of union, you know, a social union, or you could say, whatever term you want to come up with. You want to coin a new single word.
Partnership.
Yeah, right. Or, you know, whatever word we want to coin. You know, and the less euphemistic, the better, right? I mean, you know, make it have that solid, desirable weight that the word marriage does, right? Not some wishy-washy word. But as you read this, you have to keep that in mind, that's what the word marriage means. And, you know, like I said, we'll see quickly as we read historically, you know, it absolutely meant nothing else in ancient times. You know, there was no marriage if a child wasn't immediately produced, period. I mean, the marriage was dissolved, you know. It's sort of put together in tentative form until there's a child. And then it's only then is it an official marriage and an ongoing marriage. And the relevant are saying that's not just some outdated primitive mode. It's very important because that fact of genuine marriage is the foundation of all civilization. That has to be held up with that in mind. It's not just for the purposes of self-gratification. Marriage is something much more than self-gratification, you know, or even self-maintenance. Right, that self-perpetuation thing is in play. Remember when we read those three back there? That marriage is an institution of self-perpetuation, not of self-maintenance or self-gratification. See, that, you know, there could be a parallel institution that's for a combination of you know, self-maintenance and self-gratification, but there's not going to be any procreation in it.
When you get old like me.
Yeah. Right. I mean, just because we're not going to produce children doesn't mean we still don't need each other in a lot of ways. Okay, even beyond the immediate biologic issues. Okay, just, you know, it's handy to have a partner. You know, so
arguably that's two kids.
Yeah, I don't think that's what producing children is about—that you perpetuate your childhood.
Kids, or you decide you don't
want to
have kids, then it would be a
more of a beloved partnership. Yeah, I mean, right. See, remember how they tell you, and we just read it about the language, how we're in need of coining some more terms. So things are getting more and more complex. I mean, they have to get more complex when you cease being so coarse and primitive. Right, you know, we're not just going to kill everything that isn't some narrow thing and pretend that that's all there is that narrow thing. I mean, we have greater sensibilities than that anymore. We acknowledge the diversity of mankind, and we need to develop appropriate institutions and whatnot for the diversity of mankind, that we no longer try to, you know, exterminate or, you know, whatever. Yeah, so. You know, and that, I mean, just the very fact that now, you know, we blur sex and sexuality. And then we even bring in, you know, a language term, gender, and bring that one into play. And we have them all muddled together. And, you know, every time a scholar gets up in the morning, they dream up another epicycle of that whole phenomenon, okay? More prefixes and whatnot, okay? we all know how it's getting extreme now. So, I mean, just that very fact, I said that, you know, you see bisexuality and you might think something, that's like, no. Go back to the literal foundation of that word, okay? Yeah. Now, there are sexes. That has nothing to do with sexuality, right? In the typical way we use that word these days, right? So, but, you know, see, that, just that. I mean, the fact that we, it's like, well, okay, when you say sexuality, are you referring to sexes or sexual intercourse? I mean, you know, see, it's like we need better language so we can speak more precisely and not have it all muddled together. All right. So that's a very important thing that you want to have in place before you read anything beyond the first paragraph. Right, well, what is it? You know, if you don't know the definition of the term and the title, the evolution of marriage, you know, if you have some notion about marriage, it's like, no, it's not the evolution of that or that or that or that. No, it's the evolution of this. That's what we're going to be talking about. Not because you're, you know, rejecting something else. It's not a dichotomy. It's a focus. We're going to focus on that foundational fact that is in, it comes from mating and procreation. That's that biologic fact. We're going to speak about the social, cultural, and civilizational consequences of that as those three evolve.
Could you look up the etymology of marriage?
Marriage is just kind of goes back to sort of interchangeably men, young women. In other words, it's just it's basically a word that just means what we're talking about. It's just a word that's coined basically. But when two fertile individuals come together and have children, okay, and that's, you know, it just literally is referring to that fact. Okay, it doesn't really have any more complicated etymology than that. Like I've said at times, I mean, sometimes a word is just the word for a certain fact, right? And it doesn't have an evolutionary etymology sort of construct to it. Yeah.
From Northern Germany.
All right. Yeah. It's just, you know, it goes back to Indo-European.
Yeah.
All right. You know, it's an Andite coinage, okay, but you know, it's Indo-European. Okay, all right, what's this next little chunk here?
While religious, social, and educational institutions are all essential to the survival of cultural civilization, the family is the master civilizer. A child learns most of the essentials of life from his family and the neighbors.
And of course, yeah, you always kind of chuckle at that last little one. Oh, yeah, what my kids learned from the neighbors. Oh, dear. But, you know, in other words, we're kind of talking more about the nurture thing than merely the nature thing, see? And in your family and the neighbors are the first nurture stimuli. The family is the master civilizer. Again, another way of talking about that foundational fact. But notice that they say cultural civilization there. You're going, well, wait a minute, isn't that redundant? I mean, doesn't it go society, culture, civilization? So, of course, there's a civilization as a culture. That's where they're trying to emphasize that you're not going to have the concept of marriage in a very, very primitive state. And so, you know, this bit about essential to the survival, they're putting that adjective on there to stress the that higher element in the civilization, the cultural element, you know, not the mere societal element. Okay. What else we have?
The humans of olden times did not possess a very rich social civilization, but such as they had, they faithfully and effectively passed on to the next generation. And you should recognize that most of the civilizations of the past continued to evolve with a bare minimum of other institutional influences because the home was effectively functioning. Today, the human races possess a rich social and cultural heritage, and it should be wisely and effectively passed on to succeeding generations. The family as an educational institution must be maintained.
Yeah, I mean, you know, see an obvious thing, the point they're trying to make there, that you know, if you have very complete family structures and culture, there will be less and less tendency to try to develop some sort of externalized family substitute, right? Some group that's going to parent the child, right? So that there's all there is neighbor and no family up there, right? Just note when someone is advocating, well, you don't need families. You've got bigger groups that can just, the neighbors can do it. Yeah, you know, that's a popular thought with a lot of people, right? Yeah. See, these papers are trying to say, no. Okay, it's like, well, why? I mean, isn't it just arbitrary if it's that those two people that are influencing the child, relative to Bob next door, or Betty across the street? No, it's totally different. Why? Because up to roughly age 16, that biologic child, I see the emphasis, really starts with the biologic ones, set aside adopted issues for a moment, but those biologic children, remember, are literally connected mindily to their biologic parents, right? The child is not just being stimulated externally, but literally your mind is overlapping theirs, and everything in your mind is stimulating them. And there's no way you can turn that off, right? I can not say something and the child won't hear something, but I can't stop the child being influenced by my thoughts, my frame of mind, especially my frame of mind. That's the most important thing.
And that's biologic.
That's just innate. Yeah, that's just, like they said. I mean, that's why.
So does it go grandparent too? In other words, is it that biologic, or do you think it's just a?
Well, no. I mean, again.
You know what I'm asking?
It's only. Yeah, I mean, it's just the child seems to be separated when it comes out of the womb.
Right.
But that's just materially separated. It takes 16 years before the child is mindedly separated. That's why. If a child dies before they're, basically 16, they have to be resurrected in the probationary nursery, and only if at least one of their biologic parents is resurrected in the first mansion world, because, the child doesn't have a separate mind yet. You have to have one of the biologic parents, because that child is inside that parent's mind still. I mean, that's why.
That opens up a whole can of worms. It's like, well, what? Okay, but we don't want to go down that whole road. I mean, when you go down that road, it's like, well, what if this and what if that? What if I adopted a child and their parents because their parents both died and blah, blah, blah? Okay. Right. Nothing in survival value is ever lost. So we don't literally have to sort through all the physics, even if we can sort some of it out. Don't forget how the creative mother spirit has a personality influence that's guiding a child up until roughly age 6 when they get their own personality. Okay. So if she can kind of play that substitute personal influence up until that point, she can probably make up for lots of various things. Because, of course, it's all her mind anyway, right? It doesn't matter if my children are a lot older than 16. It doesn't change the fact that I'm still in her mind, okay? And so is my child.
And the same thing doesn't happen to you until you leave the local universe.
Right. You're not out of her mind womb until you are, have mindal birth when you leave the local universe,
Kids don't come with an instruction manual.
Yeah, see, so isn't it handy that instruction manual that is given to you by grace at roughly age 6 when you're inserted in the Holy Spirit, that instruction manual is still connected to the child?
I just remember when having children, and find myself, it wasn't me talking, it was my father talking to me. His voice. And it's like, where did that come from?
All right. Yeah, that you just kick in that instinctual response, and that reminds you why, you know, that relationship to, you know, of parenting is so important. You know why you can't leave Jerusalem without getting that one way or another indirectly, because there's a number of things that just aren't stimulated in you until you are in that mode. You know, you can't learn certain things any other way. There's no other 5 million year substitute or anything. It has absolutely no other way to get that except through directly helping to parent, you know, at least helping to parent a child, you know, or a certain number of children, whatever the council decides you need, right? okay. Let's see here. That's right. This was one of the things when we were on that mode explaining that. You know, don't forget. You know, that whole bit of like, you know, the owner's manual connected and stuff. I mean, like I said, the framework influence is so important. You know, it's not so much the specifics, you know, connected, but that framework. You know, you give a child a framework, a rough framework, so that they don't have to do anything on their own, you know, any of those prerequisites of adjust or indwelling. Like the child doesn't have to make it to third circle or something, right? Because you have an adjuster, that adjuster is in your framework, and you've superimposed your framework on the child, that means an adjuster can come into that framework in that child at roughly age 6. Yeah, so you don't need Pentecost.
This is all
superconscious
stuff.
Yeah, it's all superconscious stuff. See, that it's all, you know. Yeah, it has nothing to do with, you don't have to think this or anything, yeah? I'm going to give my child my framework. No, you don't have to do that. It could be 500,000 years ago, you know, and if one of the parents has an adjuster, that child got an adjuster at roughly age 6. That's why every child in the probationary nursery gets an adjuster at roughly age 6. It doesn't matter if they came from a world that doesn't have the spirit of truth yet. Their parent has at least one biologic parent that's on the first matching world has an adjuster, obviously. All right, so the child can get an adjuster at roughly age 6. Let's see. What else did we have here? Notice, you know, we just talked about cultural civilization. See how they do the opposite, or the first sentence in the third paragraph. The humans of olden times did not possess a very rich social civilization. See, so just putting the emphasis on the more primitive, basic aspect, in contrast to, you know, the more sophisticated aspect with cultural civilization. And so all of the, you know, you just see how they're building up this parallel between biologic evolution and inheritance, and social evolution and inheritance. You know, as such, they had they faithfully and effectively passed on to the next generation. Right? If it's faithfully and effectively, it's just as definitive as literally handing chromosomes to your child, right? because we're going to be talking about social evolution, as you saw there in the opening paragraph. That thing that is so controversial in some quarters. Because it all goes back to that notion of social Darwinism. Remember that, how controversial that is. Okay, so what about this? You know, see, obviously, we're going to start with the basics. Okay, let's not think immediately about marriage. Let's think about biologic foundation, not just mating. Okay.
One, the mating instinct. Notwithstanding the personality gulf between men and women, the sex urge is sufficient to ensure their coming together for the reproduction of the species. This instinct operated effectively long before humans experienced much of what was later called love, devotion, and marital loyalty. Mating is an innate propensity, and marriage is its evolutionary social repercussion.
Okay, so there you see it again at the end, right? What we've just been talking about, with the parallel between biologic and social. Yeah, when you got to love, was later called love, right? We've talked about that. It's like, well, that's kind of down in the lower levels of meeting, quote unquote, love. But, in that first sentence, can you understand what the deal is there? When they say, notwithstanding the personality gulf between men and women, you know, okay, well, wait a minute. I thought all there was creator personality and creature personality, and that all creature personalities are the same. There's no gulf between them. Unless they're talking about the absolute uniqueness. Like, no, that doesn't make sense. It can't be going to, existential absoluteness. That doesn't fit into the, personality here is just short for personalized selves, right? What's fundamentally different, of course, is the selves, right? Because of the genetic difference between the two sexes, and the mind is attuned to the genetics. I mean, it's the same adjutants. They're not different adjutants, male adjutants and female adjutants, no matter how much it seems like it is that, right? It's just that the genetics is so definitively different when the mind is attuned to it. You have those adjutants functioning in a very different mode, to a full degree. There's no way I can make my adjutant mindal self function in the ways that happen automatically with a female, right? I mean, I can try to stretch my mind and use my first adjutant, but I can't get to it. I can never get my first adjutant to have a maternal instinct. No matter how much I squint and stretch, right, it's not going to happen. I can't use the first adjutant that way because I would need different genetics and everything that results from that, all the chemistry that results from that.
I hadn't thought about that. If it weren't for the personality, if it was just the difference in sexes, the difference wouldn't be so great. Somehow, personality identified with that mindless self accentuates the differences.
You could say yes, okay, but more immediately, that whole super additive consequence thing that I was talking about happening, that requires personalized selves. Right? Let me say this distinction is vital, for in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole, right, through the individuality of the whole. I mean, that, you're talking about your personality allows you to become part of this systematized fact that connects through the individuality of the whole. And see, that's why, it's not magical that there's a super additive consequence. There's another fact in play. The mother connects the two together, right? It appears there's just two individuals. No, there's always three, right? The reservoir, you could say, out of which the superness of the consequence comes, right? You're not a creator being that can produce something above you, in some mystical, interaction or something. She's above you. It's within her that this consequence is birthed. Or maybe you just think conceived. Maybe is a more precise way to think about it, right? It's conceived within her. They're just pointing out. I mean, we're just talking about mating here. It's just, salamanders do it, okay? This is just, pretty basic facts of molecules interacting, with a little bit of mindal over control. It doesn't require your personal patterning of spirit directing mind in order to get a conception to happen. Okay. thank goodness, because there wouldn't be any children on the planet if it required personality. It's sad to record.
Right? It's all terrifying. Nothing's going to work, but nothing's happening.
And I think we all know that even when two personalities are engaged in this act, you tend to drop to the basal levels of your animal nature, and your personality is shut down, okay? Effectively. Get all that fog out of the way, or focus, boy. All right, so yeah, you know, they're just making that obvious point. All right, yeah, mating is an innate propensity. Right? That's just what the mind is urging the molecules to do. Right? Just like my mind urges my hand to move in front of my face. Let's keep going.
Sex, interest, and desire were not dominating passions in primitive peoples. They simply took them for granted. The entire reproductive experience was free from imaginative embellishment. The all-absorbing sex passion of the more highly civilized peoples is chiefly due to race mixtures, especially where the evolutionary nature has been stimulated by the associative imagination and beauty appreciation of the Nodites and Adamites. But this Andite inheritance was absorbed by the evolutionary races in such limited amounts as to fail to provide sufficient self-control for the animal passions, thus quickened and aroused by the endowment of keener sex consciousness and stronger mating urges. Of the evolutionary races, the red man had the highest sex code.
Okay, just a little tidbit at the end about kind of what happens naturally in the Sangiks. Things like keener sex consciousness. Well, why? Well, you get some Andite uplift. There's a little bit more of self-aware selves. You know, the reason that the primitives, you know, it was just also a matter of fact and not even really aware what was going on with themselves is because they just have so little self-consciousness, right? They're just kind of a non-reflecting, directed blob of molecules, right? And they're just functioning. But you get a little bit of spiritual uplift, technically, seventh adjutant uplift, which leads to more use of your encirclement in the Holy Spirit. There's going to be a more self-awareness, and you start to kind of become aware of all this, and feelings you have about it. Like we've talked about, animals have feelings, but they aren't aware of their feelings, right? So the primitive human has just a little bit of awareness of his feelings. He kind of is just, he's kind of like an animal, right? And you get a little more spiritual uplift, you have more and more awareness of your feelings. Right? It just brings in all, everyone knows what they're talking about with our whole romanticization of sex and stuff. Notice they mentioned in there that you have a little bit more with, one Sangik mating with another Sangik because you have a differential there. So you have a little bit of a super additive consequence. All right, so you get a little bit more top-down happening, but nothing like what you get when you bring some Andite in. Yeah, that pushes you up to a much higher vantage point, and you can start to kind of see the whole thing and imagine all kinds of elaborate stories in this wonderful space of you. Okay.
I think that's what happened to Eve and Cain or
whatever? That's sort of emotional stuff, came into play, obviously, during the deed, as it were. Right, like I always joke, and his bronze pecs were glistening in the moonlight, okay, that comes in right at the very end, okay, but remember, that was all just very sober, Adam and Eve's, they're just children producing machines, in a lot of ways, it's all very matter of fact to them, she wasn't caught up in a romanticization of, ooh, what would we like to have sex with a Nodite, that was all just, we're going to, it was all just very technical and planned out. But, like I said, like I reminded us at the time, don't think that she was some cold, feelingless blob of protoplasm. Okay. let's see. Let's see, anything else there? I guess we got everything there, didn't we? That last little comment, you know, which is true in general about, you know, we got, because of the default, we got just enough Adamic blood to sort of quicken the adjuvants, you know, like they weren't functioning so dynamically before, but not enough to really get on top of them and get them under control. You know, you just juice them up, you know, and they race towards the horizon in every direction. Yeah, but, you know, in all these cases, you know, the war thing, remember, that was really stimulated by anti-stuff, but not enough to really kind of manage that better and bring it under control. So we have that general problem with all of the animal urges get juiced up, but there's really not innately any self-control. So you have to choose all of the self-control, and you need a lot if you have andite uplift. Right? You need very little if you're very primitive. You kind of just are, you know, like, I don't have to control this table. It just sits there unto itself just fine. Okay? You know, in the same way, like they tell you with, if you have a basic andinite, it's like child, they're very passive and docile and whatnot. You can just plop them and come back 3 days later and they're still sitting there and whatnot. You know, but we all know if you got a lot of andite juicing, I mean, mom needs to keep a sharp eye. You set them down, you turn your head for 2 seconds, and they're gone, right? And they're out in the street, right? That's an andite baby.
There's tires squealing.
All right. So all these things, it's just an... You know, reflect on where, you know, what a basic animal nature is, and, you know, you can paint this spectrum in all these different ways. Okay, let's keep on.
The regulation of sex in relation to marriage indicates, 1, the relative progress of civilization. Civilization has increasingly demanded that sex be gratified in useful channels and in accordance with the mores.
Right, so, yeah, sure, there's self-gratification, like we were just saying, involved. But the more civilized you become, the more you recognize the ever more remote consequences of an unregulated phenomenon. And the relative progress of civilization. Let's see, anything else there? Notice that interesting use of useful channels. You know, see, that kind of gets you thinking. It's like, well, you know, there's that very useful channel for the ongoing of civilization, that there is a next generation. Okay, see, and that, if you're focusing on that, see, like we were saying, that's really the marriage institution that's seeing to the regulation of that. But, right, there are other uses to pairing that one can think about. And so, you know, because it's a different usefulness, you know, that just means it's a different institution. It, you know, requires different regulation and whatnot. Okay, so just when you think about it in practical terms like that, you can help to see why you need to not have everything all blurred together. Why does the tax code treat married couples different than singles? Okay. Things like that. See, there's a different regulation, you know, in play. That one's very obvious. If the civilization doesn't have a next generation because they're taxed oppressively, that's a problem. End of your civilization. So you try to lighten the load, the tax load a little bit.
And your tax revenue.
Right. So it's, those sorts of things. That's, when you say useful, you're immediately in a practical mode, right? Your material pragmatism has to be leading, not your spiritual idealism, right? In constructing the regulations and then, you know, the the nature of the institution.
Then they need, you know, larger families to have more workers.
Right, and that's right. You know that usefulness, right? Encouraging lots and lots of children, because if you don't, we're all going to starve to death. You know, or you know, and there's also practical things like, we don't have any really medical arts, let alone science. So you need to have 10 kids because 5 of them are going to die before they get to 10, and whatnot.
In our lifetime, the reverse. In China, mm-hmm. you only not necessarily off with your head if you didn't obey it, but mm-hmm. only having one child.
Right, to be able to regulate population. And, you take some of those old mores, even kind of maybe more primitive, they're like folkways, even kind of more than mores in some senses, like, needing lots of kids to help you farm or whatever. Religion, and way back then, takes a hold of those mores, and existentializes them, right? And you go forward, ages and ages, and, you're not allowed to use contraception. Because we don't want to limit the number of children. I mean, all those, how this works. Religion is just this, all kinds of fossilized mores, which just shows you how consciously it's not a religion. It's only by the grace of our superconsciousness that it's worthy to be called religion, because it's all about outer life stuff, that's been falsely absolutized,
The religions that encourage more want just to grow their religion.
Right. And then there's those that decided that the way they were going to embody purity is that no one would procreate. That religion didn't last very long. Yes.
The meaning became instant.
Because sex is just evil. So I'm going to stay pure. You're also going to be the only generation of your great religions that you've just spent millions of dollars to construct. So that's number one there. Okay, so this regulation of sex in relation to marriage indicates, that's our number two.
Two, the amount of andite stock in any people. Among such groups, sex has become expressive of both the highest and the lowest in both the physical and emotional natures.
So immediately when you get some spiritualization, the double-edged sword comes into play, right? And, where you start to get this unnatural wielding of your mind, you not only can focus upward or downward, right? Like we talk about loyalty. Well, okay, that's a double-edged sword. If your definition of loyalty is loyalty to your baser instincts. I mean, that an animal, can't be in that mode, right? Like the loyalty of dog, he can't, I'm going to direct my loyalty downward to my baser instincts. I mean, that's not possible. It takes a human to do that to the third adjutant, right? To direct it down to your baser instincts. And we get extremes. We get just utterly horrific abuses, right, of free will, fixated on, on perversion. Remember, perversion means turned all the way through, right? You, by grace, you're this way, and, has turned, and the per is all the way through, right? You rotate it 180 degrees. There is no perversion in an animal. Only a human can rotate that and direct it downward. Be careful how much ability to manipulate your mind, okay? You need some wisdom to go with that will. Ask Nod.
The Sangic races had normal animal passion, but they displayed little imagination or appreciation of the beauty and physical attractiveness of the opposite sex. What is called sex appeal is virtually absent even in present-day primitive races. These unmixed peoples have a definite mating instinct, but insufficient sex attraction to create serious problems requiring social control.
Yeah, see, again, the double-edged sword thing. And, you know, notice they just picked it up and kind of unpacked it a little bit more when they, what did they say that first time they hit on that? Where in the heck was it? When I was talking about the beauty and stuff before, I didn't make a note of exactly where that was in that paragraph. But, you know, anyway, here it is, you know, again, the imagination and the appreciation of beauty. You know, I mean, obviously they're talking about, you know, related to our physiques. Right. You know, we all know the way we have a tendency to respond to the naked form of the opposite sex. All kinds of things start happening in your imagination, right? You know, it's hard for us to even imagine that that wouldn't be. It seems innate, you know, and well, it is basically, but it's not inalienable, right? I mean, you can have a human that doesn't have any sort of imaginative response to the naked form of the opposite sex. Totally matter of fact.
There's no porn in the cave.
right. None of those cave drawings, yeah, or whatever, yeah. But we all know what modern graffiti has a tendency to look like, yes. Yeah, especially in the bathroom stall. Let's see here. Okay, so that's, let's see, unmixed. You know, here we're, you know, we're just focusing on that mating instinct. We'll get to the individual instincts in the two sexes as we go forward, and trying to clear up our potential confusion about that individual issue, and just that whole, you know, we all know that some of the most intractable problems that our societies face is the sex urge. You know, it's just, you know, causes no end of calamity, you know, ourselves. I mean, we're just so much our own worst enemies. And just to think about it, that the reason for that is you've got a little bit of biologic uplift, but not as much as you should have gotten, right? You know, how many families have been destroyed by an unregulated sex urge and, you know, whatnot, so. Okay.
The mating instinct is one of the dominant physical driving forces of human beings. It is the one emotion which, in the guise of individual gratification, effectively tricks selfish man into putting race welfare and perpetuation high above individual ease and personal freedom from responsibility.
In other words, it's a vast conspiracy by the life carriers, okay? And you should, you know, when you, if you reflect on your relationships, you know, just occasionally you have to pause and chuckle. It's like, oh, yeah, that's that vast conspiracy thing. Those life carriers, they're just insidious in this regard. Right? You can have all kinds of fanciful doctrine notions in your head and whatnot. I don't need a man. Yeah, let's see how long you can hold out on that one, okay? I mean, it's just inescapable in most of us. You know, even if it boils down to just the, boy, it is kind of handy to have that opposite sex around at times. You know, it has nothing to do with sexual intercourse or whatever. I mean, it's just, you know, the fact that we're so incomplete in and of ourselves, people who start out with all these, like, I'm going to have a religion and none of us are going to procreate, right? I mean, yeah, we get reality pushes in and clears our minds of these fanciful imaginings that we can, you know, produce. These isms, right, that we can try to live. But I love that, in the guise of individual gratification. see, they use that that self-gratification. It's like, oh, they won't be able to resist this. You know, they're gonna inescapably bring in the welfare of the race and the perpetuation of the species.
To he who's been given much.
Yeah, and just the one little thing there, you know, the fact that they say race welfare. You know, remember how instinctively, you know, like Blue Man wanted to be Blue Man and not some crossbreed. And so we must procreate. So there's continues to be Blue Man enough to fight off Red Man or whatever, right? You know, you get that sensibility comes into play. Because, boy, wouldn't that be horrible if Red Man took over the earth? You know, each race is thinking, you know, about the other races like that.
Well, that is even fear today.
Yeah, right. It just gets, you know, it goes from those pure line races to, you know, these secondary and tertiary sort of quote-unquote races. White man against black man, Caucasoid against Negroid, or whatever, you know. Okay.
As an institution, marriage, from its early beginnings down to modern times, pictures the social evolution of the biologic propensity for self-perpetuation. The perpetuation of the evolving human species is made certain by the presence of this racial mating impulse, an urge which is loosely called sex attraction. This great biologic urge becomes the impulse hub for all sorts of associated instincts, emotions, and usages, physical, intellectual, moral, and social.
It's all, you know, relatively straightforward. Note the precision language things that help you to that you can leverage off of to reflect more holistically on what the truth that's flowing through a paragraph. Like when you see them going from biologic urge to impulse hub, right? As they go from just the mindal urge to a spiritual impulse. And that radial picture of saying hub, you know, which is the sense of the word impulse, that you're sort of using your personality to focus and kind of have a nucleus, you know, that about which everything is constructed in a symmetric form. They're definitely pointing out, it's this kind of like what they said in the previous paragraph. The life carriers have designed this to be a spark that in the greater context of a human, you know, generates subsequent phenomena. Like the urge of loyalty leads to the spirit of courage. Okay, keep going, I guess.
With the savage, the food supply was the impelling motivation. But when civilization ensures plentiful food, the sex urge many times becomes a dominant impulse, and therefore ever stands in need of social regulation. In animals, instinctive periodicity checks the mating propensity, but since man is so largely a self-controlled being, sex desire is not altogether periodic. Therefore, does it become necessary for society to impose self-control upon the individual?
Unless you call every 7 minutes periodic. But we all know that the point they're trying to make. We don't go into heat. Okay. So again, it just, you know, they're like, you can see how they're just, you know, like I said, they're getting us to think about the mating instinct foundation, but then all of the social stuff that has to come into play, most of which doesn't happen naturally. It takes more and more reflective. It's like, oh boy, okay, this is a problem. Okay, what are we going to do to try to manage this? And the primitives came up with very crude ways of managing this, some of these issues. And as we evolve, we have to come up with better and better ways to manage these things because this problem doesn't go away. And again, you can see when you finally get out of the nutrition epoch in the security age, especially once you get out of the security age as well, you get to the material comfort era, all of those basic things are kind of just happen, and many can kind of just take it for granted, that there's always food at the grocery store down the street or whatever, no big deal. I can, if I don't have something in the fridge, I can just zip over and, 5 minutes later, I've got what I want. So you give that, this idle mind is the devil's workshop thing comes into play, right? I mean, the sex urge many times become a dominant impulse and therefore, ever stands in need of social regulation.
When I read this, I try to compose cause and effect. So why does man doesn't have the periodicity? Because he's an eternal being. That doesn't make any sense. We're created, but we're not periodic because we were created that way.
They're trying to actually point out, right, you weren't created that way, you evolved up to that, to the state where that you could be encircled in the Holy Spirit, and it doesn't matter how unconscious this fact is, there is an over-control of the, there is an upper domain, right? It's added to your lower domain. That upper domain is dominant over the lower domain, whatever is up there. Right, it's just inescapable that it's controlling at some limited degree. You have to take delight in cultivating, getting it all the way to self-mastery, obviously. But when you take an agitated mind up to the heights that we have, it has subtler and subtler elements, elements that... you're all the more susceptible to being disrupted by by very minimal influences. Right, so you have to bring in some unconscious over control to kind of keep the top of the pyramid there from being knocked around. Right, it's a very subtle thing. That's sixth and seventh adjutant, but also because of the sixth adjutant, it's a very energetic thing. Like we've talked about many times. But a lot of that is taken care of just innately by having the seventh adjutant be a governor over the sixth. Right? If you only had six, like I pointed out many times, why aren't there any beings in the universe that just have the first six? Because that's inherently unstable. Right, that incredible energy of the six would just instantly tear the mind apart. Right?
We can witness a little bit
today. Right. If you don't have the seventh adjutant in some mode, some minimal mode, right, especially if you have andite uplift and stuff, right, the zeal would just slam you against the wall as a splat. Okay? But you have this. Yeah, so the seventh adjutant comes in, it's like, okay, we got it puts a basic box on the sixth, okay, at least until you get to in the 20s, and when you can start to really will the double-edged sword issue. But like I said, that's the subtlety of, taking it right up to the neck of the hourglass there. That's a very subtle thing. It needs some innate over-control from the encircled and the Holy Spirit to kind of keep it, keep it stable. And as you go forward a bit, even to continue to hold the sixth adjutant in some check, right? It's kind of drawing its energy, if you will, from that spiritualized mind above.
You're talking about the sixth and seventh adjutants, but isn't the sex urge or the sex sync on the first level? On the lowest?
Yeah, sure. But just, you know, remember how this all started out. You know, you said that, don't we just aren't we just made to not have that periodicity? It's like, well, okay, it appears that way, but see, it's all in what, you know, what comes into play when you add the sixth and the seventh and the circuit and the Holy Spirit. Yeah, you know, that makes it a, you know, but see, it's you aren't innately sort of more uniform and stable. You're, you know, that those things make the mind like that. Those top down influences, I mean, you don't have different lower adjutants than the animals do. It's the same. You know, see, if you didn't have that over control, your adjutant mind would function in the same kind of periodic fashion. Very, very primitive peoples are a little bit more like, this episodic sort of sex thing, you know. They don't even think about it most of the time. You know, they got hunting to think about and whatnot, you know. And just sort of, there's a certain time of the year, you know, like in the spring, when the animals kind of remind you, oh yeah, I'm feeling a little frisky today. Right?
That comes up.
Yes, right. I mean, see, that's just, right. Until you bring in that higher stuff, you kind of do function in that sort of, you know, periodic animal mode. Right? The seasons influence you more and these sorts of things, see? And we all know, humans, because we're animal origin, some humans are very sensitive to the seasons, you know, and they just sort of ride the roller coaster of the seasons in a very subjective mode.
And the moon.
And the moon and whatnot, right. Right, and we have the term lunatic, right, and these sorts of things. Right. So more and more that you have, you know, that over control, it seems to naturally just, you know, be more, you know, remember what that spiritual nature, that unity nature is continuumness, right? So something that's normally kind of oscillating a lot, it smooths it out. You know, it's harder for the individuated mind to fluctuate if you bring the rigidity of spirit into play. You know, that's why we have spiritual strength. You want to be all flying, you know, running around with your hair on fire and stuff, but no, you bring some more tension into it, more spiritual strength, right? And it can't flail about. Yeah. You know, or the warp and the woof thing, you know? I mean, where's the integrity in the, you know, in the weave? Is it in the warp or the woof? Is it in the spiritual fibers or the, you know, physical fibers? All those analogies. All right. Let's see. Where were we? I lost our place. Let's see. Put it in. We were in the. Let's see. Oh yeah, this one. The periodic checks. Yeah. Okay. So we just had that last paragraph, don't we?
No human emotion or impulse, when unbridled and overindulged, can produce so much harm and sorrow as this powerful sex urge. Intelligent submission to this impulse, to the regulations of society, is the supreme test of the actuality of any civilization. Self-control, more and more self-control, is the ever-increasing demand of advancing mankind. Secrecy, insincerity, and hypocrisy may obscure sex problems, but they do not provide solutions, nor do they advance ethics.
Okay. Let's just pretend. It's like, no, let's not. And of course, there's the self-control, more and more self-control. What was that?
Oh, that famous quote from the late 1990s. I never had sex with that woman.
Yeah. That when unbridled and overindulged can produce so much harm and sorrow. Right. Again, that, you know, using that bridling, you know, influence or analogy that we often use. You know, they're using it there again. You know, something needs to pull back on the reins, especially if you kind of just innately, like with the Andite thing, have juiced up a lot of the urges so that they're almost kind of like innately an impulse, right? It's just, you know, ever more so. That thoroughbred needs a bridle. Right? And again, that, like I was just about to say, the self-control, more and more self-control, I think most your longtime readers remember that line, okay, but have you fully internalized it, right? I mean, that's what it means to be a human and a progressing human. Now, you're not a human, in effect, if there's no sign of self-control. That's a fancy animal, right? To even be a progressing human, let alone an advancing human, okay, that means more and more and more self-control, right? And it's sad to record that so few persons on your rancha, right, have any self-control, and hence, in effect, are functioning as a human. So we wonder why our civilizations are unstable, right? Remember, that's the whole point of the founding fathers. I think that maybe at least some of us on the planet can exercise enough self-control that we can have greater freedom. Let's try it. And we're going to give you a republic if you can keep it, if you can maintain the requisite self-control. But as soon as you think every day is May Day, it can't, we're going to have to go back to an absolute monarch. And he's going to have to chop off your head if you don't behave yourself. You know, we can't say, let's have an elaborate multi-year court process, fall to all. And they're like, no. It has to be tighter than that. Right? We all know that there's just, everything has gotten so loosey-goosey, right? So there's just no way to, we haven't replaced that requisite definitiveness of the monarch. You can't say you don't need that anymore. You absolutely need that, something like that. It's like if you give up war, there has to be something to replace it. You can't just imagine it's totally there unnaturally or something. No, it's a natural outlet. So what are you going to do to replace that? If it isn't external, it has to be internal. Can you overcome your natural state of, that's warlike enough with self-control? It's like, no, I can't. I was like, okay, well, let me give you football then. Okay? But I got to give you something because I don't want war. So either you bash your brains out, in the name of a game, or you get a hold of yourself. But I can't imagine that the source isn't there. Okay. So, all these things. And obviously, when all is said and done, if it's going to be an advancing civilization, it can't be just some sort of crude external substitute. Right? It has to be internal at a high degree. And social architect mentalities, I don't understand that. They think that they can somehow just make some wonderful, magical, external construct, that makes it so that there's no hatred and no war and just peace and sunshine and lollipops everywhere. I think it's communism. That's what it is. Everyone will be just happy. It's like, no, there is no such thing. It's not control, more and more control. It's self-control, more and more self-control. But, we don't have that, so guess what? We're going to have secular totalitarianism. And the fault is with the individuals, not those who want to be the wielders of that totalitarianism. The problem is in the individual citizens that aren't adequately self-controlling. It leaves a vacuum, right, that someone's going to fill. If it's not a monarch, it's got to be something like a monarch, like a totalitarian state. And boy, if it has no sacredness to it, boy, that's going to be an ugly totalitarianism.
Back 50 years ago, in elementary schools, they had grades on report cards.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things on the report cards was self-control.
Yeah. See, and that's why it's there. Like, oh, I never thought of why it's there. Yeah, see, because we used to try to pass civilization on to the next generation. We're actually testing kids. Okay, are you rising to the challenge of being a citizen of a civilization? Or are you just a feral animal? I mean, now, everyone gets a trophy. No? Yeah, you can see the problem. All right, what else do we have here?
2, the restrictive taboos. The story of the evolution of marriage is simply the history of sex control through the pressure of social, religious, and civil restrictions. Nature hardly recognizes individuals. It takes no cognizance of so-called mortals.
Morals.
It is only and exclusively interested in the reproduction of the species. Nature compellingly insists on reproduction, but indifferently leaves the consequential problems to be solved by society, thus creating an ever-present and major problem for evolutionary mankind. This social conflict consists in the unending war between basic instincts and evolving ethics.
Okay, so notice how that one ends with ethics, just like the last paragraph of the preceding section. And, if to help you, what they mean by so-called morals, and why are these morals so-called? Okay, because what we, what you're actually talking about, with what we call have always called morals, is not genuinely morality. It's at best ethics, it's just the mores, the taboos are part of the mores. They aren't something that's apart. And it's like, well, if it's just about the basic mores, that's ethics. And if it's about the taboos, it's morals. It's like, that's what we kind of have thought, because when we think of immorality, it's like, oh, it's that sex thing, sex taboos. It's like, no, morality doesn't have anything to do with sex taboos. Absolutely nothing whatsoever. It has to do with conformity with the cosmos, not distance from the taboos. Okay. That's why that's what the so-called is in there for. Let's see. Indifferently leaves the consequential problems to be solved by society. Well, that marriage just got broken up. Now, who's going to, support the child? And, I guess society is going to have to pitch in a bunch of money. And, all these issues that we know. She just had sex with a neighbor, and her husband came over and killed them both. Right? And, all the soap opera that comes from this. This social conflict consists in the unending. Again, you can't imagine that there'll be some time in the future when this conflict won't exist. It's in this life, perforce, you serve two masters. Okay? It'll always be there. Seventh stage light in life. Right? It'll still be there. Okay? But it will be under control. Brilliantly. Full control. All right. Okay, let's keep going.
Among the early races, there was little or no regulation of the relations of the sexes. Because of this sex license, no prostitution existed. Today, the pygmies and other backward groups have no marriage institution. A study of these peoples reveals the simple mating customs followed by primitive races. But all ancient peoples should always be studied and judged in the light of the moral standards and the mores of their own times.
Okay, so when they say among the early races there was little or no regulation of the relations of the sexes, we're talking about the horde, right? And you go all the way back before families to the horde. You know, so obviously there's no marriage institution, right? I mean, no families, no concept of families. It's just a horde, you know, that occasionally one element of the horde bumps into another element and they notice their opposite sexes, and it's just that time of year and things happen, okay? So, I mean, that's what they're talking about. So, you know, so obviously they want us to think about going forward from horde to clan, you know, sitting in families, you know, and into clans and tribes, etc., that sequence. And then, of course, it's throwing in that little twist of remembering that, you know, this difficult problem we've talked about a lot. We have people, like they're pointing out there, in all of these, this whole spectrum of states, people that aren't into clan yet, right, etc., all the way to those that are imagining, envisioning light and life now and stuff. So, you know, not only when we're judging things in the past, you know, does their admonition come into play there, but, you know, judging the pygmies, say, or whatever, or the, you know, the Libyans, or, you know, whoever it is. Like one we often hear a lot about is, you know, all of this out of evolutionary context judging of Saudis. Well, they're evil because blah, blah. It's like, no, okay, they're still back in a very early stage, and you got to let them evolve naturally. If you go in there and fiat change things, you'll blow up the whole society. You've got to let them evolve. You know, and if they finally let women drive, you shouldn't say, oh, that's just so they just let women drive, blah, blah. You know, I mean, you can't judge it always in that negative mode. You go, okay, cool, that's a sign. You know, maybe 500 years from now, they'll be a little bit farther down the road. You've got to think long term. How long did it take to get the leading edge of civilization that kind of used to exist in the United States into existence? It took 1,000,000 years to get to the beginning of the 20th century. And then we started throwing it all away. All right.
Free love, however, has never been in good standing above the scale of rank savagery. The moment societal groups began to form, marriage codes and marriage restrictions began to develop. Mating has thus progressed through a multitude of transitions from a state of almost complete sex license to the 20th century standards of relatively complete sex restriction.
Yeah, until you had the dawning of the sixth agent and the collective, and there wasn't the over-control to manage it, and all just went loosey-goosey in the middle of the 20th century.
Remember it well.
Yes.
Free love.
Yeah. Yeah, and everyone knows that sentence. Yeah. Scale of rank savagery, not just basically animal savagery, but the depths of savagery. Yeah, that's a sobering line. It's like, no, we're on the cutting edge of civilization, you know, with the free love. No, you've just gone all the way back to the horde. You've just erased 1,000,000 years. It's like, well, how can that just happen? There's none so blind as those who will not see. That's using your spirit over mind control to primitize your mind, pre-primitize your mind, like we talk about a lot, right? To just totally erase everything that it's inherited socially through all the generations. Just erase it all with this new spiritualization of your mind. Yeah, that's a great example of, spirit is innately divine. If there was a spiritual, you know, advancement in the middle of the 20th century, you know, we're all, no, see, there's a double-edged sword. And the more spiritualized you are, the sharper the blades become. You know, the edges of the two sides of the blade. So you can not just drop back to tribe, but you can drop all the way back to horde. if you're spiritualized enough. And so, yeah, and that's, yeah, that's that sentence, not only might it give you, like you start staring at your toes, but, you know, setting guilt aside, you know, it's one of the most definitive things that you can, that sort of everyone recognizes, that points to the emergency situation on the planet. It's like, wow, we can erase things that easily? You know, in a couple of years, you can go all the way back a million years? Yeah. So that's an emergency situation. And all this slow evolution of civilization could all be lost in a heartbeat.
And, you know, the sad part about it is that most people don't even know it.
Yeah.
They aren't aware of the evolution of mankind on the planet. It just...
Yeah.
You know, either they believe it all started 6,000 years ago, because that's what they were taught, right. Or they don't even care.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, there's no...
Right, if it's sha-la-la-la-la, live for today, which also came from that free love time, right? Right? Let me erase all my foresight.
There's
and,
some
you
truth
know.
In all we need is love.
Yeah, if only there was a sixth level of meaning definition of love. Yeah, and I was just, thank you, gave me a great transition there. I was just going to get to that other little technical point. On the sixth level of meaning, there's no problem with that genuine love, free love. I mean, it is that love is by definition free. That's there by the grace of God, right? The liberty that you discover on the sixth level of meaning, the genuine love. But you know, we're talking first and second level here, okay? Kind of love. Yeah. I mean, they challenge you in many places to remind yourself of how you can define love on each of the levels of meaning. And can be defined on the first level, the second level, etc. Back there when they, where was it that they said? What came to be called love, or where, you know, wherever they said that, that affection, you know, that deep affection that, you know, we've, is part of the romanticization of relationships. I mean, that's second level meaning love, you know, what they're talking about there. That's one of our biggest challenge, that it can be very, very, there can be a very, very deep feeling, as we call it, on the second level of meaning. But that, you know, despite its apparent depth, that doesn't make it the genuine love in the sentence, God is love. God is not a so-called deep feeling. It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Because he's not a deep, so-called deep feeling or an intense feeling. Right? That's not the substance of God. You have to get four levels above feeling to find the real God. Right? The God you appear to find in those intense feelings is a God of your own construct. It's a vivid island of heat. Right? It's not the light of the real God. And it's like, no, it's personal. Yeah, you're a personality. You personalize that vivid island of heat. You know, you're the author of that God. Right? It doesn't mean that some people don't have genuine experiences of stuff, but just recognize you got to be very discriminating. Don't be satisfied with the first thing that appears to be God. It might be just you. Now, always seek a higher experience. Don't ever be satisfied with any, you know, hierarchical state. Right? Many people, the first time they feel any upward movement, they're content. I've reached the top. Right? It's a binary reality. Right? There's heaven and earth. I've gone from earth to heaven.
There's also a place for feelings, too.
Sure, of course.
It's not just a bad, horrible thing.
Sure, if sympathy was innately bad, you wouldn't have it.
Yeah, and Jesus used emotion to quicken the mind and bring attention to when he was teaching.
But he did, he used the feelings that way, you know, like they always say, like when they speak of sympathy and compassion, that's the way they say it, sympathy and compassion, right? The foundational element is compassion in the upper domain that then is downstepped into sympathy in the lower domain, right? Jesus was a downwelling phenomenon. His sympathy was predicated on compassion, you know, his feeling relationship, you know, or even his usage, see, was in that mode. There was a spiritual motive behind his use of feeling, right? It wasn't just feeling for the sake of feeling. And it's just so important. Again, the only way you can actually engage someone else is through your associating mechanism, the lower domain. You actually can't connect to them like compassion to compassion, literally, right? You got to bring it down to sympathy, and then you engage their sympathy, and that might inspire them up to compassion, and then they can turn themselves around and do top-down compassion to sympathy and go to the next person, right? It's just, yeah. You know, there's many places in the Jesus papers where they point out that before he did anything, he had himself definitively flowing top-down, right? So it was a genuine phenomenon and not a self-serving phenomenon. It was a God-serving phenomenon.
Well, any movement up would be something that it's worth pausing,
yep,
and reflecting and appreciating.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
That where you are then, and then reflecting on what else might it be.
Yeah, and if you reflect on it, you'll go, ooh, that's really cool. I like that step up. More of that, please. Right? You know, don't just try to, you know, bliss out in the feeling of having taken one step up. Right? Just, you know, see the essence of it and do that again. Let's go up another level. Yeah. Okay. Good grief. I don't even remember where we were. Let's see. Oh, yeah. We did the first paragraph, didn't we? Oh, no, that's right. We did. Oh, yeah, we're clear over here. Right, we did free love. Okay, see, I told you I didn't know where I was. What?
She knows where we are.
Yeah. she has to, because I'll say, give her the point to her to read the next sentence, and she's got to read the correct sentence. Let's see here. But see, you know, I get so non-linearized that I can't remember where we are. Okay, let's see. I just want to make sure we didn't skip anything there, that tangent I just went off on. Just saying that we've gone from almost complete sex license to relatively complete sex restriction. And obviously, restriction is a good thing, like you're just saying, but all good things taken to extreme become bad. You can't over-restrict it, or there's going to be a rebellion, you know, against that. There has to be some, you got to allow for some space for people to function. You can't be utterly oppressive, or you'll just, you know, the more you don't let someone have sex and some outlet, all right, the more you're going to have all kinds of very problematic societal consequences.
It seems like the quest for perfection has a lot of that. The difference between the over extreme and not over extreme, but it doesn't mean don't do it, it just means there's a certain point at which it works out okay, but.
Yeah, and the more advanced you get, the more that moving things back and forth to the balance point has to be done inside of the individual rather than external influences, you know, pushing back and forth and trying to find the sweet spot. Self-control, more and more self-control, right? Okay.
In the earliest stages of tribal development, the mores and restrictive taboos were very crude, but they did keep the sexes apart. This favored quiet, order, and industry, and the long evolution of marriage and the home had begun. The sex customs of dress, adornment, and religious practices had their origin in these early taboos, which defined the range of sex liberties and thus eventually created concepts of vice, crime, and sin. but it was long the practice to suspend all sex regulations on high festival days, especially May Day.
Festival. yes. Like I was referring before about May Day, because I knew that was coming up. you have to chuckle at that deep parenthetical up front there. This favored quiet order and industry. that's a funny one. It's like, okay, now we're going to get something done. Focus, people. you can kind of pursue them yourselves, all these, various customs that, are trying to facilitate the appropriate separation between the sexes. Just quickly, I'll read you a sentence coming up in a few papers. That whole bit about vice, crime, and sin. There it is. Up here in, what is this, paper 89, section 2, it says, the habitual violation of a taboo became a vice. Primitive law made vice a crime. Religion made it a sin. Because, of course, transgression of taboo is the old, still definition of sin. All right, so that, just to remind you of how that worked, when you sort of had vice, but as you started to actually separate, the so-called sacred and secular, then you got crime on the one side and sin on the other side, how that evolved and get those separated. But it all, as we all know, the vice cops, or whatever, they're dealing what we think of as morality, that so-called morality they mentioned, right? It's the secular segment dealing with what religiously is considered a sin, those taboos, transgression of the taboos. We keep, adding more and more taboos. It's a taboo to smoke, or it's a taboo to, whatever it is, to have too much alcohol, or whatever the vice is, added to the society.
Well, I was a teenager in the 60s, and I can remember the girls, hemlines were rising.
And rising.
And they used a ruler to measure.
Whether or not you could get in the school door. Yes. If your hemline was too high. Yes, and we all know there was lots of interesting stuff in those free love days.
I didn't think May Day went back that far.
Yeah, that goes very far back. They're just pointing out sort of as soon as there was any sort of sophisticated regulation of the sex propensity, it was like I said before, it immediately became apparent. We're going to have to have a release valve on this, or everyone's just going to explode, and the whole society is going to blow up. So you got to have a pressure, release valve, periodically, and kind of go back to the horde thing for a little while, and then okay, now we'll go back to being a tribe.
Major holiday today.
Yeah, horde for a day. That was just a crude way of doing it. Instead of having some sort of a more sophisticated system that didn't have to that didn't treat it in a binary fashion like that.
That became the alarm call for the pilot in trouble
situation. Yes, there's nothing but trouble here. Mayday, mayday.
the thing is, like, well, wouldn't that be horrible for the females, you know, to be thrust into this? No, they delighted in this too. I mean, everyone was into this. It's like, ooh, I can hardly wait, you know, for all kinds of interesting activities tomorrow. You should never think of it as some sort of a male, you know, scheme to have their way with females. So the females were completely into it.
Some females are not.
Right. But back then it just, you didn't have some sort of higher sensibility that would say, no, I'm not going to be involved in that. It was, that's again, I just mentioned, I have to judge it by their times. You can't think the way you think now. Now, I wouldn't submit to that. Yes, if you had been born back then, you would have none of those sensibilities you have now. You know, like, I have to take a shower, every day. You wouldn't have that sensibility. Or, I think, bad breath is horrible. Or, all those things have just developed. No one had any of those thoughts, back in the day.
Didn't, though. Can you look at that a little different? If there was more Andite, or because they were, Andites were able to do things like, things that we don't even see now. They used their mind. They had to.
But again, remember, don't think that gives them some sort of an innate purity or divinity or something. See, like we said, it's just.
So culturally, they were more advanced culturally.
It's like, one of the examples of this, you run in, we read about Adam and Eve. It's like, you mean that brothers and sisters were mating? That's horrible. That's an abomination. That's a total sin. See, I mean, yeah, but see, no, see, there isn't any sensibility like that, amongst them. You just have to think, and see, and they're a great example. Why wasn't that some sort of a taboo thing? Because, they have this more animated mind, like you're saying with the Andites, but they also are willing that mind to have certain unnatural responses. I mean, the taboo about that, they're going to talk about that. See, it's natural to develop a taboo about that. And Adam and Eve, and their immediate offspring and stuff, I mean, they're a very non-natural, non-evolutionary sort of, philosophic mind. So, they aren't subject to, because of their enculturation to thinking about things the way that we naturally think about things. Another example they bring up that's so startling is that jealousy, there's nothing natural about jealousy. What do you mean? Jealousy is an inescapable natural thing. And they say, no, that's a training of your, basically your first agent and stuff. That's so basal and so definitively trained that it's as if it comes from your DNA. Right? But it's not. You just, it's like saying, well, if I see something startling, I can't help it. I have to scream. Yes, you can help it. That's you're bred to be that way. You're trained to be that way. We definitely have it biased a lot to, if I'm a female, I'm somehow weird if I don't shriek, I mean, you're taught that. You just have to, you have to get a control of your, not only of your genetics, but of the nurtures that are coming in, right? You have to be the master. You can't be a helpless victim of antecedent causation like that, where you just are nothing but a reaction. No action. No, you're not an originator of anything. Okay. Now tell me again, where are we? Oh yeah, Mayday. We just read Mayday. Is there anything else there? I guess we have everything. Yeah, go ahead.
Women have always been subject to more restrictive taboos than men. The early Mores granted the same degree of sex liberty to unmarried women as to men, but it has always been required of wives that they be faithful to their husbands. Primitive marriage did not much curtail man's sex liberties, but it did render further sex license taboo to the wife. Married women have always borne some mark which sets them apart as a class by themselves, such as hair dress, clothing, veil, seclusion, ornamentation, and rings.
Right. I mean, you know, you go, oh, that's just so unfair or whatever. It's like, no. You got to think about it practically. You know, why were they subject to more restrictions? You know, because they're the ones that, you know, have a baby in their womb. And that that offspring, there's all sorts of hereditary things. I mean, if you're going to pass your fortune on to your firstborn, okay, you got to know that's your firstborn. Right, you know, all the ways the society was regulated, you start shattering that if you can't definitively know. Now, of course, we'll see they weren't very consistent or objectively causal in their thinking about some of these things. But they're trying to have a balanced system. Right, it's not you're not treating the marriage sex stuff apart from other issues, right? They've got a holistic system in some mode.
And they invented the chastity belt.
Yeah, right, the chastity belt. And, yeah, various things come into play if they're uncertain of your ability to control yourself. We'll read about it. We all know as soon as, got notions of virginity and stuff like that, all these things, doesn't matter how arbitrary the notions is, it becomes systematized, and everything has to conform to whatever the notions are. Okay.
3. Early marriage mores. Marriage is the institutional response of the social organism to the ever-present biologic tension of man's unremitting urge to reproduction, self-propagation. Mating is universally natural, and as society evolved from the simple to the complex, there was a corresponding evolution of the mating mores, the genesis of the marital institution. Wherever social evolution has progressed to the stage at which mores are generated, marriage will be found as an evolving institution.
Right, so The very last sentence there, the element that maybe not immediately appreciated there, whenever social evolution has progressed to the stage at which mores are generated. Okay, remember we talked about folk. I even mentioned it earlier today. Sort of the very natural folkway phenomenon evolving into mores. One of the times when we were talking about that, we were contrasting in the mode of how natural tribes are and how unnatural nations are, beginning unnatural a nation is, and thinking of going from folkways to mores as you go from tribe to nation. Here, don't think quite in that mode, but the same essence of folkways are developed so unconsciously, and as soon as you get sophisticated enough, where you're starting to think more about the general welfare. Right, you're thinking a lot more systematically. You're getting up and you're reflecting. Right, so there's a conscious element that's entering in, and you're then see that conscious effort takes it from the unconscious folkway to the conscious mores. So that's what they're getting at here. See the stage at which mores are generated. So you're getting this more humanized, conscious, reflective phenomenon is constructing these organizing principles for your society. Okay, as soon as you get to that more reflective mode, marriage will be found as an evolving institution. It very much is. Oh wow, I can see that. In order to promote the general welfare here, we're going to have to have a marriage institution. We have to begin to you produce some framework and, you know, some and consequent over control in that area to properly fit it into the whole system. And okay, so that's what they're getting at there. You can go back and, you know, see how they speak of, you know, unconscious and unintentional about folkways. Okay.
There always have been and always will be two distinct realms of marriage. The mores, the laws regulating the external aspects of mating, and the otherwise secret and personal relations of men and women. Always has the individual been rebellious against the sex regulations imposed by society, and this is the reason for this age-long sex problem. Self-maintenance is individual, but is carried on by the group. Self-perpetuation is social, but is secured by individual impulse.
See, so there we already started talking about it, you know, hearkening back to those three, self-maintenance, self-perpetuation, and self-gratification. You know, so just, can you see how that works? You know, self-maintenance is individual. You know, as an individual, you're hungry, right, or you're insecure. But you know, it's carried on by the group, right? It takes the group to see to it that everyone has food to eat, you know, it takes you know, a group to have enough security for any individual. Right? And so when we talk about that nutrition epic security age, you know, that's fostering a more systematized and effectively functioning group back, you know, modes of activity, right? To satisfy those, you know, those individual issues. You know, but self-perpetuation is social, and self-perpetuation is social, but it's secured by individual impulse. And again, I mean, you know, the group needs a next generation, like we were talking earlier, right? Self-perpetuation is social. I mean, the individual doesn't need a next generation, right? The group needs it. Yeah, but again, it's secured by individual impulse. So that, you know, that the complexity of that, like they were saying, this age-long sex problem, you know, that you've got this complexity of how you establish a system, how, you know, how do you both think about the individuals and the group at the same time, right? You know, you can't think in dichotomies like we tend to do. It's like, well, I'm all about individuals, you know, individualism. It's like, no, forget about individuals. You know, I'm all about the collective, right? Collectivism. The innate falsehood, you know, of both those, right? I mean, there isn't truth on one side of that dichotomy and falsehood on the other. No, they're both false in any sort of a sophisticated sense. Just like, well, I think it's pacifism. No, it's militarism. Well, they're both false, okay? It's a false dichotomy, period. Pacifism and militarism are both false. So, you know, that's what they're trying to get at there.
Because it takes one element as an abstraction.
Right. Makes it a complete lifestyle. There just isn't any validity to taking such a microscopic concept and making it the everything. Right? It's not even remotely up to being a temporary everything. It's just, you know, like we've talked about, you know, there's a temporary appropriateness to nationalism. But eventually that has to be let go. Not nations, but nationalism. So there's a temporary, you know, but something like pacifism or militarism or, you know, whatever, I mean, it's not even an evolutionary, stepping stone, scaffolding concept. You know, it's just not valid. Did you have something, Gene? Okay.
Ismizing is the false expectation.
Yeah.
Right away.
I mean, it's just, you know, you know, in the fullness of the ism where you're trying to existentialize something. Okay, no. But, like I just said, there may be, you know, there isn't a perfectness to that ism, but there might be a perfectingness to that ism, right? So that there's a certain span in an evolutionary process where that's a proper motive. So, you know, it's a spiritual thing, the ism, right? That, you know, tribes can be challenged by that motive to rise above what's natural and be a nation.
If we were secure in our nationhood, nationalism would be negative.
Right.
But
if we're
having a hard time hanging on to the nation, right. To have someone proclaim themselves, I'm a nationalist, right. I mean, trying right. to engender some...
Right, we all know that this... we've talked about that extensively. I mean, everything is going tribal, right? So... the only solution is to get a spiritual motive. You want to think of a nation as a value to strive for, not eternally, right? But man, if you're if you're falling back into tribes, or like we pointed out, with free love, if you're willing yourself back to horde state, the other fact of the horde state, communism. That is severe. The ism that you want is not communism, it's nationalism if you're in that mode, if you're so backward like that. And then once you have a very, very stabilized, secure nationhood, okay, then you can definitively set your sort of spiritual sights on internationalism. And be very, very cautious about that globalism sort of notion, right? And if you're not sure about that, say, well, what about what it says about global government up in the Jesus Papers? Go back and look at that section, right? And you'll notice that there's two things that you probably missed in that statement about global government. One, that global government must be a representative government. Right, and where there's a there's a democratic system, that's set up, across all the nations of the world, where those people elect these representatives in that global government, and they're accountable to the people. Right, the European model is not European Union model is like no those aren't elected, officials, and they're not accountable to anybody. So number one, right, it has to be a representative government. And number two, never ever will it have anything to say, no matter how far you go forward into the future, never will that global government have anything to say about what's within a nation. They only will have say over international issues. Now, again, European Union bureaucrats, want to dictate the minutest thing down in the nations. Absolutely inappropriate. Right? And it just means that it's doomed to die soon. Right? The more they, get their nose down in people's business, in the nations, the more they're sealing their fate, they will be eliminated. Okay, the European Union will collapse, and everyone will go back to nations again.
There's no glide slope. It's a nosedive.
Think within the next few years, that's going to happen. I mean, it's almost there already.
Kevin knows.
States of the United States. Yeah. And of course, and when they use the example of the United States, that should get you reflecting. Oh, we've got a problem. More and more the federal government is burrowed down in the details in the states. No, the only thing they should be dealing with is interstate. Yeah. And of course, foreign affairs, right? But, but within, only interstate. I mean, there's almost nothing but, down in the depths. They're not only within the state, they're within the county, They're within the municipality. They're in your bedroom, right? It's just it's so completely inappropriate. Right. Yeah. So, it's very likely you should go back and reread precisely what it says in that section, and you'll find that it doesn't say at all what you thought it said. It isn't validating globalism the way that term is used, right, these days. Not at all. The opposite of it. All right, let's read one more paragraph here.
The mores, when respected, have ample power to restrain and control the sex urge, as has been shown among all races. Marriage standards have always been a true indicator of the current power of the mores and the functional integrity of the civil government. But the early sex and mating mores were a mass of inconsistent and crude regulations. Parents, children, relatives, and society all had conflicting interests in the marriage regulations. But in spite of all this, those races which exalted and practiced marriage naturally evolved to higher levels and survived in increased numbers.
See, survival of the fittest there in your social evolution. Again, they're strengthening that. The more you go forward, the more complex a problem this is, and the more wisdom and insight and foresight that you need. And like I said, because you have all kinds of conflicting interests, like they're saying, the individual and the collective, just before that, we were just talking about. It is very difficult and ever more difficult innately to find a way where, people aren't so frustrated that everything goes into rebellion. Right, to find a way that people are regulated, but not endlessly frustrated, right, and oppressed. And it's a very, very complex problem and has ever more subtle issues to it the farther you go forward. And like you were saying, there is so little reflection on all this stuff. Obviously, especially all these subtleties and complexities and stuff, this is going over everyone's head. No one has a clue. Not to mention, no one has a clue why a number of things evolved, right, and are in place. We've talked about that before. It's like, this is just arbitrary. Let's throw this out. No, it took a million years of random, trying to finally discover, that one actually works. And the million other ones don't work. And we think, this is just arbitrary. No, all we're doing is going back to one of those random other things that we tried 100,000 years ago and found it was just cataclysmically didn't work.
And what's interesting to me is that here we are, luckily, on this world, observing this, working out pretty much evolutionarily, because the, excepting for the Jesus revelation, the other two revelations, petered out.
Mm-hmm.
So, like the first one about civilization, it's gone, so we're having to really take all this long period of time going through all these steps we're reading about,
mm-hmm.
In a supreme way, I guess you'd say, in a total evolutionary way, without having, a couple hundred thousand years of being taught and guided and so on and so forth. And the same thing from the biological side.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's something, it's an experience that most worlds never have.
Yeah.
That's kind of interesting. That's why I imagine it's so cool for people to come and look at this thing and see how, it even works when we don't help it work.
Right.
It's like
evolution achieves that which revelation failed to accomplish. Look at that.
Fascinating.
I'm sure. It's like, I didn't think there was any other way to get to that except with an integrous planetary prince. But look at that. You actually, I didn't know that was potential in the system. But it is. And it's a really reassuring thing for them to tell us that. We can stop hyperventilating so much, okay? It may look bleak for a while, like it did for a couple years on Gerasim, right?
Yeah.
But things sort out. through the evolutionary process, because there's an over-control of evolution.
And we're lucky enough to be experiencing that.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a, yeah, it's a very, very, it's a fascinating world, and it's a world, very productive world. You know, this world produces things that no other world can produce. Essential things, right, to the completion of the Supreme. Right, to be part of such a a special conduit of evolution, right? You'll look back, it's like, wow, that was really cool. You know, it's like I was born on the world that Michael chose for, you know, his seventh bestowal. I mean, it's not just that. There's all these other things, see, that I was born on the only world in the local universe of Nebadon that allowed it to get to the local universe settled in light life. Right? Yeah, so a lot of those sorts of things, you know, are it's so helpful. And then you were bringing up, you know, all, telling us about all these things. You know, don't ever forget that the book has to do two things. It can't just reveal truth, because we are so ignorant of so many things, and, you know, even historically that we've lost and stuff or don't appreciate anymore. They have to coordinate essential knowledge first, and you have to synchronize with that holistically, and then you can begin to find the truth that's predicated on that complete factual foundation. Without that, without that factual foundation, truth can't be accessed. You can have all the goodness internally in the world, but it takes fact and goodness to go super additively up to truth. Okay, well, we'll stop there. I see it's a kind of a long section. We'll pick that up next time and finish it off. Lots and lots and lots. This is never-ending fun stuff in these marriage and family papers. Yeah. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.